Today, we are welcomed by a very special guest. Ali Beth Stuckey is a wife, mom, cultural commentator, and is the beloved host of her podcast, Relatable. Ali, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So your new book, Toxic Empathy, had an interesting statement in the synopsis talking about how it's not about killing empathy, it's about submitting it to God's definitions. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so Toxic Empathy is out October 15th, and I really wanted it to come out before the election because the purpose of the book, my hope is in the book, is to give Christian women in particular and Christians in general the equipment and the tools to have conversations about the topics that are considered most contentious today. They're typically called culture war subjects, but really they're biblical subjects. So abortion, sexuality, gender, even immigration, and social justice. These are the subjects that I see Christian women in particular, again, but you could say the public in general, they are manipulated by what I call toxic empathy. And it is when empathy, so our ability or our pull to put ourselves in someone else's shoes, is used as kind of a mallet of manipulation to get someone to take on the progressive side of an issue or to take on a progressive stance. So it typically looks like, say, the media. I use an example from NPR when they're reporting on abortion. They tell this heartbreaking story of a woman named Samantha who found out at her 20-week ultrasound that her daughter had a genetic condition that made her what some doctors call incompatible with life. But she lived in the state of Texas, and at 20 weeks, she couldn't get an abortion. So NPR told this story about how heartbreaking it was for this poor woman who was already a mom of eight. She was poor. Now she had to watch her child die and pay for a funeral. And of course, what NPR is trying to get the reader to feel is empathy for the woman, empathy for her plight, and not only that, but to affirm that the choice of abortion would have been righteous, would have been good and compassionate and loving for her. But the reason why I say this is toxic empathy, because empathy, feeling how someone else feels, isn't always bad. It's also not always right. It's really just kind of neutral. What makes it toxic or healthy is what it actually leads us to believe or leads us to do. And NPR used toxic empathy because what it did was manipulate us into ignoring the real victim in the story. The real victim in the story was the little baby named Halo, who thankfully she was able to survive and she was able to be born and she was able to die a peaceful death in her mother's arms and to hear and feel that she was loved. However, she would have been a victim of a violent abortion. And so the media and left-wing activists and really any pro-choice or pro-abortion proponent, they hoist up one victim, which is the woman, and encourage us to ignore the real victim, which is the baby. They want us to put ourselves in the shoes of the woman who feels like her only choice is abortion, and for us to forget about what abortion is, what abortion does, who it actually harms, which happens to be everyone. Yes, physically the baby, but it also harms entire communities and, of course, moms and dads too. So what I want to do through this book, and I do the same kind of thing in every chapter, I look at, okay, what are the anecdotes that progressives are telling us should put us on the progressive side? And then we look at a counter anecdote, because we can go back and forth all day telling victim stories on each side of an issue. But what's most important for the Christian is, what is true? What is true? Yes, we can hear sob, heartstring pulling stories all day that seem to make a different kind of competing point. But what is actually true? And that's the difference between empathy and love. And I know I'm going on a really long explanation right now, but that's the difference. Christians are not necessarily called to empathy. It can be good to put yourself in someone else's shoes, but putting yourself in someone else's shoes doesn't tell you what's true. But love, as God defines love, and he gets to define it because he is love, 1 John 4:8, is inextricably intertwined with the truth, because 1 Corinthians 13:6 says that love rejoices with the truth. So it's not enough to feel, it's not enough to feel bad for a victim that the media hoists up. We have to think as Christians, but what is true, what is good, what is right, according to the God who made us.
Right. And along the same line, I think a lot of Christian conservatives were really disheartened by Trump's and the GOP's backing away from the original pro-life stance, because we see how empathy is used by the left as a weapon. But then Christians are also a little confused why it's kind of being used by the right as a political pundit. So what's your answer to Christians that are a little nervous about voting for Trump because of that?
Yeah, I totally understand that. And I and a lot of my pro-life friends were in deep disagreement with President Trump about the different things that he said about embryonic life, whether it's forcing taxpayers to fund IVF or whether it is supporting a compromise on abortion. But what I know is that Trump can be influenced toward life. He can be influenced towards the pro-life position. If it comes down to replacing Justice Thomas or Justice Alito in the next 4 years, I know that I want President Trump to be the one to appoint that replacement and not Kamala Harris, because whoever Donald Trump appoints is going to be more on the side of the Constitution than someone like a radical like Kamala Harris would, because she supports expanding and packing the court, which is a very radical position. And of course, we saw his change in rhetoric when it came to Amendment 4 in Florida. It's really important for people to know that Amendment 4 would allow abortion through all 9 months in the state of Florida, even though right now they do have a heartbeat law. And Trump kind of equivocated on that when he was talking to NBC. He said, oh, 6 weeks is too soon, which seemed to imply that he was going to vote yes on the amendment, which is terrible. But I know a lot of pro-lifers, I don't have a personal relationship with Donald Trump, but I have friends who do. And I know that there are a lot of pro-lifers in his circle who said, no, like, this is not good. You can't vote yes on this. You can add, you know, you can believe what you want to believe, but this is a radical position. You cannot support this. And he changed. And he openly said that he changed. Like, do we honestly think that Kamala Harris, who has been an abortion activist her entire career, a rabid abortion activist, do you think she could have been influenced in that way? I don't. So unfortunately, of course, we're looking at two people who are imperfect,
right?
But we always have. We've always been looking at, to a greater or lesser degree, a battle between the lesser of two evils, because no one is perfect, and we're not voting for a pastor, and we're not, obviously, not voting for Jesus. So at the end of the day, we've got to ask ourselves which policies will do the most good, what will bring about the most order, which leader is most susceptible to good godly influence.
Right.
I think the answer is clear.
Absolutely. And a lot of Gen Zers, my generation, are of voting age, and we're very, like all young people, very susceptible to peer pressure, susceptible to what our professors are telling us, susceptible to what our friends are doing. So what encouragement can you give to my age group who is going to the voting polls this November and they're easily swayed?
Yeah, I think it can be easy to feel like nothing matters and to be apathetic if you're on the conservative side and all of your friends are voting liberal and you don't want to have to tell them that you voted for Donald Trump or that you didn't vote for Kamala Harris. I think fear and wanting to fit in is something that, you know, everyone has always felt, but especially when you're young and your friends and relationships are everything to you. As you get older and you pay more taxes and you have kids and you buy a house, you realize that other people's approval of how you vote matters less, or else you should come to realize that.
Definitely.
But the younger you are, the harder it is to kind of stand up against your friends and hear really awful things. Because it's not just, wow, I disagree with you anymore. It's, wow, you're an awful person. Do you hate marginalized communities? Are you a bigot? Or are you a racist? Like, awful things that no one wants to hear. But if you haven't developed the steel spine and the thick skin that hopefully you get through adulthood, then it can be really difficult. But look, none of those people who are going to defriend you, unfriend you, whatever you want to say, because you're conservative, because you're voting your Christian values, because you vote against Kamala Harris or for Donald Trump, however you want to see it, none of those people who would separate themselves from you because of that are worth being your friend. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be friends with people that you disagree with. I have friends that I disagree with on certain things, but people who would write you off as some kind of bigot for voting for the more pro-life candidate, those people aren't worth being friends with. Maybe you need to share the gospel with them, but they're not friends that should influence you because they're not going to be there in the long run for you anyway. So that's what I would say. Reject toxic empathy. Think harder. When you hear a headline that it's like, wow, Republicans really are as awful as I've always thought. And you could really apply this to both sides. If something sounds too good or too bad to be true, then it's a really good idea to stop and think, okay, but is this true? What is true behind this? What's the truth behind the headlines? For example, like J.D. Vance, the Associated Press, they quoted him as saying that school shootings are just a, quote, fact of life. Well, that was part of his quote. The whole quote was, I hate that this is now considered a fact of life.
Right.
Totally changes the quote when you look at the full context
of it.
And the media is playing that game all day. So it's up to you to not be lazy, to not be dumb. Don't let the media or social media or podcasters or influencers or anyone make those decisions for you and shape your worldview. Go to the Word of God. Use the brain, the capable brain that God gave you, to really think through the issues and think and pray through what God's Word says about each of them.
Right. And like you were saying, that God's word gives us discernment. And it's actually one of the fruits of the Spirit, that we are able to have wisdom and self-control. And the toxic empathy, I would think, goes along with having self-control, of not allowing your feelings or the culture to dictate what you think. And that's so important for every aspect of life, but especially, Allie, in the aspect of dating. Gen Z, maybe you've seen this, the plummeting marriage rates, it seems like, and the dating awkwardness, and we can't get off our phones, we're on dating apps, it's not working out. Isabel Brown and Brett Cooper have talked about this dating crisis in our generation. And you've been married for years now. Do you ever compare what dating was like with you and your husband and what it's turned into nowadays?
Yeah, you know, I'm very thankful. I've been married 9 years today.
Congratulations.
And thank you so much. And, you know, there's a meme that has gone around for years. It's like, those of us who are married feel like we got the last chopper out of Nam. And we kind of do feel like that, because I have, you know, I have beautiful, wonderful, godly friends who are single. Yeah. They're my age. So they're millennials. And I know from them, at least, you know, in our age bracket, and as you said, I'm sure it's true in Gen Z too, that it's tough out there. Like, the dating app scene is tough. Like, finding a guy who is not going to ghost you and is not going to act in a way that is immature can really be tough. And I know guys feel the same way too, which is like, it's funny, because I wish that the guys and the girls who both feel like that about the opposite sex, that there are no good guys, that are no good girls, I'm like, y'all should all just get in a room. How do I like, how do I pair you
off?
Let's
make an event.
Yeah, how do I pair you off together? And so I'm very thankful that my husband and I, like, when we started dating, it was 2014. And so it was like right at the dawn of Tinder and all of that.
Okay, but so you missed it then.
Yeah, I never used a dating app. And we just met at working out, actually, at kind of like a CrossFit type gym, and just started talking. And we didn't like have a texting relationship or anything. Yeah. We would just see each other every day at the gym, and we would talk for long hours, just standing outside in the parking lot, outside the gym, literally until like 10 p.m., just talking.
That's amazing.
And I knew really quickly that I wanted to marry him. And then it just went from there. So that's considered like an old-fashioned romance nowadays, because we really didn't, like, we didn't have social media really that we were checking on and all of that. And that kind of thing is still, I still think it's possible, but both men and women, I think, have to step up their game. I would say for young women, you have to go out of your way to show when you are in public that you are like interested in talking to a guy. That doesn't mean be forward. That does not mean be aggressive, but it does mean making eye contact and asking questions and smiling and not sitting off by yourself, like with your friend when you're in a public space. It means going to all the places that Christian guys are. I think like working out at like a small boutique gym is a great idea. Obviously going to church, volunteering, different places like that, different ministries. In my area, there's a lot of coffee shops where I know like a lot of young Christian people are. Going places like that and going out of your way to talk to a stranger, of course, within like polite social norms and all of that.
Right.
But then I think guys have to be very forthright too. I still think today that Gen Z women are attracted to that. Attracted to men who know what they want, who are clear about their intentions, who lead the way. And I still think it's possible to find love in the Gen Z dating world.
Definitely. I met my husband at my church. And one of the things that I don't want to say attracted me to him was he was very blunt with me, which at first I was very unused to. I was used to beating around the bush and, I kind of like you. I'm going to make you feel weird for 3 months. But with him, he just came up to me and I talked to your dad. I really want to date you. I'm like, let me get back to you on that.
Yeah.
But I do see a lot of single women wanting that, and they want to, you know, put themselves out there and they want to be married. And a lot of people on the right are saying, you know, get married young, have kids. And they're like, well, I don't know where the guys are, for one, but two, I'm a little guilty. I feel guilty that I'm not married. So what do you say to women who want to be married, but they are stuck in singleness, they feel like?
Yeah, I always do kind of wince at those messages a little bit because, again, the single women I know, it's not for lack of trying and it's not by choice. Yes. They would, like, they're doing all of the things and it's just not time for them yet. Mm-hmm. And it's not like I have some perfect answer as to why that is. I don't know why. I don't know why the right man hasn't come along. But what I would say to those women is that don't fall into the lie, which I think is a satanic lie, that your life does not start until you are married or a mom, that you're not a real woman until you get married or have kids. Those are wonderful things. I love being a wife and mom. It's great to aspire to those things, to even prepare for those things, work towards those things. But don't think that God can't use you fully right now. Don't think that your path of sanctification and fulfillment is going to start in some far off day, because I know it maybe someone would say, well, it's easy for you to say, but this is just the truth, that we're not guaranteed everything in this life that we want. We're not promised marriage. We're not promised kids. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know if or when those things are going to happen. So don't wait to have joy. Don't wait to pursue the Lord. Don't wait to be used by God. Don't wait to work with children, even in different capacities. Like, there are so many opportunities for you to fulfill your calling as a woman and as a nurturer, even before you get married and have kids.
Right. And I think that maybe that plays into a little bit of a lack of true identity, that our identity is not in our husbands, because our husbands fail us. And the honeymoon phase of, oh my goodness, he's so perfect, wears off very quickly when you start living together and you see, wow, we're both sinners.
Yeah.
So if you place your fulfillment in who your husband is, it's going to fail. If you place your fulfillment in your role as a mom, you just don't have enough in the tank to do that. That whether you're single or married or struggling to have children or have children, your identity is in Christ, ultimately. And that's something I really loved about your first book that I'm going through, of this toxic culture of self-love. But our generation is also very terrified to have kids. We're drowning in student debt. The world seems to get crazier and crazier. I know you just welcomed a new baby a year and a half ago.
Almost a year.
Oh my goodness, wonderful. Did you ever experience those fears of bringing children into the world?
Yeah, of course. I think I felt them more before my first, because I didn't know what to expect. And I was more anxious after she was born. But the more kids I have, the more I realize how okay it is. Not that the world isn't scary, but that God has equipped all of us as moms to disciple our children and to steward their hearts as best that we can, and that God doesn't do anything accidentally or arbitrarily. He didn't place us when he did on accident. He didn't place our children where he did or when he did on accident, and it'll be the same for our children's children and so on. Yes, we do live in scary, precarious times, but guess what? Christians have, for a very long time, some generations have experienced more stability than others. But just look back even over the past 100 years, and not just in America, but around the world, the things that Christian parents have had to endure, far scarier times than this mm-hmm. one that we're dealing with right now. I mean, if you think about the Christians under Nero, the Christians in the early church, and how justified they were to wonder, oh my gosh, what kind of world am I giving to my kids? And yet they were fruitful and they multiplied. Like, what is the best antidote to the chaos and the craziness and the cruelty of this world? It is kind, courageous, and strong and wise and godly children. That's like the best gift, the best medicine that we can give a sick world. Is strong and wise and godly children. And if we're not going to have them and raise them, who is? So yes, it's scary, but we get to raise our kids in a scary time to be brave and to be strong. That's our call as Christians in this era.
Yeah. And kind of on the same line, most of our listeners live in Big Blue, Illinois, the aspiring abortion capital of the United States. So there are a lot of families here that feel the weight of not only the high crime, but the high taxes and the immorality of our leaders. Yeah. What encouragement can you give to Illinois residents?
Yeah, gosh, some of the strongest and most courageous Christians I know live in blue states like Illinois and like California. And while I completely understand and have even in the past advocated for people, for the sake of their families and their children, moving to places that are more conservative, and I totally think that's an option on the table for people, I obviously don't condemn that at all. But at the same time, I have gained more understanding and sympathy for those who say, no, this is where God has called me. I'm gonna stick it out. And there is an opportunity to be an even brighter light in the darkness. And we can think about these times that we're in where Christianity is really becoming less mainstream and more marginalized as more in line with historic Christianity. Again, going back to Nero, certainly Christianity then wasn't cultural. It wasn't part of the mainstream. It wasn't accepted. And Christianity thrived on the margins. It has always thrived on the margins. That's why we're called to be light, not in brightness, but in the darkness. And so there's such an opportunity for those who are pro-life, for those who are pro-family, pro-baby, those who are pro-God in a state like Illinois or a state like California or Washington or so many of these states to shine really brightly, to be a refuge of clarity and courage when there are so many vulnerable people looking for some kind of source of truth and stability.
Yeah. Well, Allie, thank you so much for your time, your encouragement.
Thank you.
It was such a blessing to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Yeah.